So you were home for a month, and then it was time to go back?
Yeah, yeah. So I went back, and I flew back again, and I think that was the time that we went through Alaska and Alaska and Hawaii in the same trip. I still cannot figure that one out. But anyway, and I remember standing in Hawaii for like 45 minutes thinking, man, it would really be nice to stay here. You know? But I had to go. So anyway, I went and I reported in that's the company I transferred to.
Okay.
Was the 240th Assault Helicopter Company. And the reason why I picked that company was because it was very, very professional type outfit. They had been there for quite a while, and they had been in a huge action. I don't know if you ever heard of Roy Benavides. He was a Special Forces sergeant, and he won the Congressional Medal of Honor, but he had to fight to get it. But he was involved in he saved 8 to 12 guys' lives, and our unit lost 3 pilot and 2 crew members in that action where he got the Medal of Honor. This was before me. Now, this was like a year before this. But they had instilled in their company that, you know, they were there to do the job. And whatever it took to get it done, they did it. And there's a website that it's called the Flight Line of the 240th. And there's a long beginning in it from this Bill Cowan, who was a Marine lieutenant. And at the time, he became a major. Actually, he's on Fox TV. He's a consultant on Fox TV. But anyway, and he'll be at our reunion this year, too. But he wrote a long narrative about why he liked to deal with the greyhounds and the mad dogs. And
the greyhounds and the mad dogs being...
The Greyhounds was our flight crew, our slick crew. We were Greyhounds. We had 2 flights, white flight and blue flight, and then the Mad Dogs were the gunships.
Okay.
Okay. So we had 4 different flights of gunships.
And where did the name slick come from?
From just being slick, getting in and out of areas.
Okay.
I'll tell you a good slick story if you want to hear that. But anyway. So I went back to the 240th. That's where I wanted to be. And we did some tremendous things. I mean, very exciting, but good work. And we always felt like we came through when they needed us, you know. I don't like to count numbers, but we averaged a company of NVA a month of hard kills. So we didn't play around with them. We went after them, and it wasn't uncommon for our gunships to be right in the treetops, right where you're defending an area, and we would go right down into the trees and blast it out with them.
And the North Vietnamese Army would be there.
Yeah. Well, and VC. It depended on what who was where.
Right.
But so we were pretty well known, you know, and the VC were afraid of us. So we had that always in the back of our mind, you know, is that they knew we were going to be the guys who were coming there. Companies would vie for us to support them because they knew that there were some companies. And I don't know why it was. You would think the training would have been the same. But there were some companies that would not go under 1,000 feet when they were firing rockets. They would stay way up in the air. And because of that, you know, there's air turbulence and stuff. They'd miss a lot of shots.
Right.
And it was not uncommon for our gunships to go into a gun roll, you know, and fire their rockets and come up and the helicopter be covered with mud because you know they were that close when they fired the rockets. You know, I mean, we were very, very proud of ourselves that we, you know, that we did what they wanted us to do. So, anyway, that's so that's why I went to the 240.
Okay, and how long were you, did you do that type of work with the 240?
13 months I flew with them.
Okay.
I flew from, I forgot when I get back, but until December of 70.
Okay.
I went home like 3 days before Christmas.
Was that the end of your
tour? Yeah,
year?
That was the end of my tour. And okay. I actually was going to re-enlist and go to flight school because I had a pilot that I became very close with who had done that. He had been a crew chief. His name was Bob Frash. And he was a really, really good guy. And again, I connected with him. But he got killed. And the way he got killed just made me lose faith because what happened was he got shot down. And having been a crew chief, he should have known better, but he ran out the door of the aircraft and the rotor blade cut the top of his head off.
Oh, okay.
And the other guys, and I talked to the pilot that was on that mission, and he told me, he said, we all wound up, you know, the aircraft crashed, and they all went to the front of the aircraft, about 100 yards in front of the aircraft, and he said, I'm standing there with the gunner and the crew chief, And where's Frash? Where's Frash? And he says to me, he goes, I swear I didn't see him get out of the aircraft, but you know I thought you know he got out. And he goes, and we went finally when the gunships were circling, so the VC booked. They went back over there, and there he was on the side of the aircraft. So, you know, having been a crew chief and going back and, you know, and I looked up to him.
Right.
And when I realized that, you know, he was under fire and he was under duress and he died that way, I thought, you know, that's exactly what the hell would happen to me.
Right.
So I rethought that, you know, really hard, and I really did want to go learn to fly. But then I said, no, I'm close enough now where it's, you know, I can go home. I'm going to go home.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, during the time, how long were you in Vietnam altogether?
A year and a half.
A year and a half.
Yeah.
During that time, I mean, that's a high stress situation that you were in. What did you do to relieve stress?
Went out and chased girls. You know, well, we had, you know. We had stress relief.
Okay.
I told my wife this story. Every week I would try to treat myself to a steam bath, you know. And they had steam baths, and I told you they had red clay.
A steam bath when you were already, it was so hot there?
Oh, yeah, but the steam baths were nice. They were nice.
Okay.
You'd go sit in a sauna,
yeah.
You know, and you it would blast all that red clay out of you.
Okay.
And then you'd shower, you know. And then you know, the girls would give you a rub down, you know, and you could get a happy ending, and you know. And I was 19, you know,
yeah.
so I wasn't adverse to this, you know. But, you know, my wife always tells me, you were such a pig, you know. But you know, I was a kid, and I could have died at any time. So, you know, who was I kidding?
Yeah. So besides the steam baths, what else did you do for entertainment?
We drank a lot.
Yeah.
We drank a lot. Yeah. We drank a lot. We had parties. We actually, when Bob Frash got killed, we had a huge party because nobody wanted to feel bad about it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because we want to honor his memory.
Right.
And I remember I got so drunk that, I couldn't even function. And I guess I made a fool of myself. I don't know, you know, that night. But the next morning, I had to fly.
Uh-huh.
The next morning, and I was hungover. And everybody on the radio was on my case, you know. But I probably took Frash's death harder than most guys, and so I let go, you know.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. They had a band, you know, and the band came into base camp, and you know, they had this little Lambretta truck, and I remember I was sitting on top of the truck, and we were rocking it. And when that truck left, we broke all the springs out of the truck because we had just rocked it and rocked it and rocked it. So, anyway.
So you left Vietnam. You came home.
Yeah.
How old were you? Still 19 or were you 20 at this point?
I was, I was 20 by then, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was 20. I turned 20 in September, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what was your rank when you came home?
Well, I was an E5. I mean, that's an interesting story in itself. That's how I became a crew chief.
Okay.
Because I was an E4.
Uh-huh.
And so I was a door gunner. I started out as a door gunner. And then one day the CO walks up to me and says to me, "Hey, Marchetti, you can't fly anymore." I said, "Why is that, sir?" He goes, "Because your E5 orders came through. Congratulations, you're an E5. So I says, "Well, what does that mean?" He goes, "You're my newest crew chief." So that was it.
That's how you became a crew chief.
Yeah, that's how I became a crew chief. But they gave me my own aircraft, you know, which you flew. See, gunners rotated from ship to ship.
Mm-hmm.
The crew chief had his own aircraft, and so you always flew on that aircraft.
Okay.
That way you took care of that aircraft.
That's right.
And the pilots knew that too. So, they had their druthers about who they wanted to fly with too. So I wound up getting, the aircraft I got was number 813.
Okay.
Well, obviously nobody wanted number 13, you know, so I wound up with number 13. But I made it lucky for me, so I liked that aircraft. It was old, but it did well. And then after we turned that aircraft over to the Army's, mm-hmm. and I got a brand new one, a 69 model of a UH-1D. I'm sorry, not a D, H model.
Okay.
And so it was 69682, 1569682 were the numbers. And I still have the tag. I had the tag for years. And my aircraft commander is Felix Bates is his name. And that's who was the aircraft commander of my two aircraft. You didn't always fly with that guy, but he was assigned to the aircraft. And you were assigned to that aircraft. And he always laughs. He goes, "You stole my pin off that, you know, off that aircraft." Yeah, I did.
So, when was it? Did you have to earn points to get home, or
was it time? It was time. Yeah.
Okay.
It was time.
So when it was time to go home, and you were told you were going home, were you relieved? Were you?
Oh yeah. Well. Actually, the morning that that I found out that I was going home, Captain Toops came up to me and asked me to fly because we were shorthanded. We were always shorthanded. It didn't matter. If your aircraft was down for maintenance, you were flying gunner for somebody else. Or you never, ever had a day down. You know, mm-hmm. There was never enough people. And he came up to me and I was going home in like 3 days, and he goes, I really need you, I'm a guy short, you know, fly for me. And I told him, I called him Dai Wee, that's Vietnamese for captain, you know. Mm-hmm. I says, "Dai Wee, I'm going home." And he just looked at me and went, "Okay." And he didn't press me about
right.
it, you know. But I lived with a lot of guilt from that because a month after I left, he got shot down, and this other guy, Bill Seaborn,
mm-hmm.
got killed in that crash. But Captain Toops wound up with numerous broken bones,
wow.
And he was hurt big time. And Felix, my mm-hmm. aircraft commander. I didn't know this for years and years and years now, mind
mm-hmm.
you. But I found out, like, you know, this was 20 years ago.
Right.
I found out about it, but 20 years, you know, went by. And I found out that happened a month to the day that
Oh, wow.
I went home. I always thought that you know, would that have changed time? You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, you think differently that way, you know. But I was done. I was pretty well wrung out by then anyway. I said,
an old man at 20, huh?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, well, then, you know, then I went to Germany for a year.
Okay, so you went, you didn't go home?
No, yeah, I went home. I went home on leave.
Okay, how long?
A month. Okay. A month's leave, and then I had to go to Germany.
To finish out your...
Yeah. So I had 11 months left to serve. I wound up serving 9 because I got an early out to go to school.
Okay.
And...
And what were you doing in Germany?
Germany, they didn't know what to do with me. They did not know what to do with me. And I really became a problem child, actually. That year, that 9 months that I spent in Europe was probably the best thing that could have happened to me, though, because I really unwound. And that time helped me put a lot of things in perspective. And I really did not want to play Army anymore, you know. So I was kind of my own kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I was an E5,
right.
an NCO. So they had to treat me like, you know, like I was somebody, but I was nobody. It was nothing. But they tried to make me an assistant motor sergeant. And I couldn't get along with the motor sergeant. I just couldn't get along with the guy. He was trying to be something that he wasn't. Uh-huh. And I didn't want any part of that, you know. And I wasn't trying to play, you know. I already been to war. I don't want to do that anymore.
Right.
You know. So anyway, in Europe, I just played the bad boy. I really did. I was.
Sowed some wild oats.
Well, yeah. Well, for example, and this is a true story. I'm not going to make anything up. This is just what happened. I just told this to these guys when we went to the VFW convention, and we were laughing. They told us, okay, we're in the field now. We're in, where the Battle of the Bulge had been. And they told us, hey, spread out. You got to be 5 meters apart, you know. And we looked at this second one time. Get screwed, we told him, you know. And he's like, you know, he comes up yelling at us, you know, what are you going to do to us? You know, we already been in them. You know, there's 5 of us here, you know. They've been in it. Get away from us. You know, leave us alone. So they got mad at us, you know. And you know, we weren't respecting his authority, but we didn't care. So they said, we had a drill now, you know. So now they go, you're going to be the insurgents, they told us. So me and these two other guys were insurgents, and I says, this is going to be fun, you know. I'm going to enjoy this. So I'm sitting back, and I'm watching their, you know, they set up their perimeter. And I'm looking at all this, and they tell me, okay, this is where the perimeter is. Well, I go the other way because I said, I'm not going to do it their way, you know.
Yeah.
I walk down the side of these trucks.
Around
and I stood in between two trucks. And I listened to a guy come up, and he challenges the other guy, you know, what's the password? I hear the password. Okay. I walk into the compound. Guy challenges me. I give him the password. Oh, okay. You got to walk through. I go hide by another tree. Listen to the password. Okay. Go up to the next section. Do the same thing. Here's the general's tent there. I walk in the general's tent. I go, bang, you're dead. They go, what? I go, I'm an insurgent. You're dead. What is this? You know, they roughed me up. You know, they actually beat me up a little bit.
Huh?
You know, but they were mad. I don't blame them. What the heck? They threw me back out in the woods. I did it 2 more times. You know, and I enjoyed it so much. You know, the third time when I hit the doorway, some captain put a .45 to my head, had me around the neck with the .45 to my head. I go, okay, well, you got me now, you know, okay. But, you know, it didn't matter. It was, but, you know, you can see why, because it was so ironic.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? You'd really think that I'm not going to beat you at your own game, you know? I know how it works.
Right.
So. Anyway,
9 months you were in Germany.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, it was the best 9 months that I could have spent because I sowed my wild oats. I had a good time. I traveled Europe. I drank a bunch of wine and I partied. And when I came home, you know, I was pretty well adjusted.
And so when you came home, you said you left 2 months early.
3 months, yeah.
Three months early.
Yeah, 3 months to go to school.
And where were you going to go to school?
I went to Triton.
Okay, for?
Yeah, for diesel mechanics.
For what you had been doing.
yeah, believe it or not, yeah.
Where were you discharged?
I think I was discharged from Fort Dix, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, because that would have been the last place that I would have been.
Okay, and what do you remember about coming home that last time?
Well, I just remember that people were very cold to us. They blamed the soldier, not the
right.
The politicians for that war, and that was a mistake. And you know, what's his name, Walter Cronkite's, you know, standing at the end of Da Nang runway, you know, saying, "Oh, this war's unwinnable." You know, I mean, I saw that myself on TV, you mm-hmm. know, and I was like, what war is this guy watching, you know? Because the one I was in, we were kicking butt, you know, taking names. We were not afraid of them. And you know, I never, ever thought that we would lose that war. Seriously, I didn't. Because, I mean, we were fighting for a reason. Mm-hmm. And we seem to have, I won't deny that their regime was corrupt. You know,
right.
the Dang regime was a joke, you know, and then Tu was an idiot. I'm sorry, but they were. But that wasn't the point of the experiment, if you're going to call it, whatever you're mm-hmm. going to call it. The thing was that there were poor people that were caught in the middle of that.
Right.
They were just wanted a normal life, you know. And the VC wouldn't let them have that,
mm-hmm.
you know. I've got a pilot who has a business in Vietnam and in America. He travels like 6 months a year. He'll be there and then he'll be here. And he tells me that those people are the best capitalists he ever dealt with, you know. Even he doesn't go to North Vietnam.
Right.
But he goes, you know, none of them call Ho Chi Minh City Ho Chi Minh City. They all call it Saigon. And it's not, you know, South Vietnam is way more modern mm-hmm. than North Vietnam is. You know, maybe it's gotten better lately. I don't know. But seems to me that, you know, we really... We missed a huge opportunity to actually do some really good in the world, mm-hmm. you know, because we should have finished the job.
Right.
Even their general, Gap, I think his name mm-hmm. was, he wrote a letter that said that they were ready to capitulate. If Nixon had only kept bombing for a day or two more, you know, and then we would have had a positive end to it,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, people would have felt better about it, and, you know, and who were we listening to? We're listening to a bunch of dopers that were saying that, you know, oh, you know, make love, not war. But come on, seriously, you know, that's not the way the world works, you know? I'm not saying war's right.
Right.
You know, the veteran will be the first guy to tell you.
Don't want war.
We don't want no wars. We got to go fight those wars, you know. No, but
yeah. So you came home. You went to school.
Yeah.
For
diesel mechanics. Yeah.
Was that on the GI Bill or?
Oh yeah, yeah. So I used my GI Bill. I should have got a bachelor's degree. I only got an associate's. But I got married in the meantime and. And then we wanted to have kids, you know, and I bought a house. And so we were ready. And, you know, I'll tell you, I've had a good life. I'm not complaining about my life a bit.
Did you make any close friendships when you were in the service that you still maintain or maintained for
a
while
after? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Actually, like I say, we're going to have a reunion,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I'm in touch with all those guys. We got a Facebook thing going on now. You know, So we have, and we have a lot of laughs, you know, there's a lot of inside jokes there. That guy in the picture that's mooning me,
right?
He's like my best friend, you know. You know, it wasn't then.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and you, I know you belong to the VFW.
Yeah, and the American Legion too.
Okay.
Yeah, I just joined the American Legion a month ago.
Okay.
But that was because another guy who's in the VFW asked me to do it, so I did it.
How did your military experiences affect the way you think about war, about military, about government?
Well, I never want to see anybody go to war unprepared. You know, we have a volunteer army now, so we should know that, you know, these are not guys that are being pressed into that. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be there for them and support them when they they come home, because they need that more than ever. Especially now, see, our military is, in my opinion, is way too small.
Mm-hmm.
We have guys going 4 and 5 deployments who are National Guardsmen.
Right.
You know, they're not even, but that's nothing new though either. You know, my DIs in basic training were all National Guardsmen who messed up and got activated.
Okay.
You know, I don't know if you know how it worked back then. If you were in the National Guard and you didn't make your meetings, or you got in trouble or whatever, you could get activated.
Okay.
That's how they got activated. So they were screw-ups.
Mm-hmm.
So if they had, you know, they then all of a sudden they're training guys. They wound up going to NAM, and then after NAM, they had to serve the rest of their 6-year commitment.
Okay.
So maybe they had 3 years gone already, you know, so they served a year in them. So now they had 2 years to serve yet. They had to serve it active.
Mm-hmm.
And so these guys were stuck doing that, you know. And when I found that out, I said, you're a National Guardsman? You know, I didn't realize that they did that.
Right.
You know, that's when I finally realized these guys are human, you know. But it was, you know, that was the 7th or 8th week of basic, and they lightened up a little bit, you know. But anyway, that's the same thing. You know, they got activated. And these guys today, they're citizen soldiers. They really, are not prepared for that. I work with quite a few of them. And, you know, and for what they've been through, they're in good shape. But they're, you know, we got the one kid, George, that I work with. He got blown up by an IED, and you know, I could see where that would weigh on you.
Oh yeah.
You know, so I just think it's wrong. I think that they really don't need to be pressed into service so many times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I look at my own experience, and I think that's a piece of cake compared to what they're going through. You know.
How did your experiences and your service affect your life, your personal life? Was it good? Was it bad?
I think I'm a pretty regimented guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my wife says I'm too straight. She tells me, but I think I'm very proud of what I did in the service. I don't feel any shame for anything that I did, because it was the ultimate motivation was my own survival and the survival of my buddies.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not want to have, I did not want to have losing a guy on my conscience.
Right.
You know, so I was going to, if it cost me my life, I would have given my life. I really would have. I'm not just saying that,
right?
Because they would have done it for me,
right?
You know, and they did. Right. Some of them did. So I'm grateful for that. And so anyway, you know, I have no problem with serving my country. I think that that's one of the simplest things you can do as far as that goes. And what I think I gained from that was I'm a little selfless in that I don't want to say no to people when they want help, or, You know, I mean, I, because I had kids, you know, I volunteered for baseball and all of that stuff and did all these things. The reason I did all of that was because it was a payback,
right?
You know, but the nicest part about being a volunteer for doing things is that you've run into a kid years later that'll remember you, you know, and say thank you to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best paycheck of all.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share, anything we haven't covered that you'd like to add before we finish this interview?
Well, I didn't, you know, I didn't talk about, but most of those things I covered in that other interview with the VFW interview. It's just that I'm just very proud of our unit. The 240th Assault Helicopter Company was a very, very professional unit. We did a lot of things that other people didn't do. I mentioned to you that, you know, we were, we did operations with CIA that other units didn't do. We did alert patrols, which were long-range patrols. We'd take special forces to the field, and we would drop them, and we would insert them, and their jobs were not to engage, but to gather intel.
Right.
And but when they would get in trouble, we'd have to go get them, and we did that several times. I don't know. You know, I just did what was asked of me.
Mm-hmm.
But the one story that I wanted to tell you was we had to go get alert patrol, and it was. It was First Light, and they were in trouble, and they were so they were radioing for help. So we go to get them, and this pilot Joe Long was his name. He's on Facebook right now. He retired the last commissioned UE. He got to fly it, to be the last guy to fly it.
Okay.
And anyway, terrific pilot, nerves of steel. And anyway, he took us to get this alert patrol. And when we got to the area where we had to pick them up, they have like beams, and they do that themselves. They got their own riggers and stuff, their guys.
Mm-hmm.
So when we get there and we go to drop the ropes, and we're not near them, so we had to walk to them. So we had to go under the canopy of the jungle. So we flew into this canopy. And you know, it's, you don't know what you're going to, it's going to be like three stories, you know, three sections, triple canopy. And we get in there, and he goes, I gotta turn the aircraft around, because otherwise I'm not going to be able to get out. So he says, you guys got to clear me. So we're looking around, it's pitch black, and there, you know, but we're seeing tracers shooting back and forth, you know, all over the place. And you know, the VC used green tracers. We had red tracers.
Okay.
And so I'm seeing green and red tracers, and I'm going, wow, you know, there's a big firefight underneath us here. And I, you know, I don't know whether I should be shooting, you know, but I wasn't going to just shoot, you know, willy-nilly. I needed something to shoot at. So I wasn't firing. We were pretty well disciplined that way. But anyway, we're under canopy, and he wants to turn the aircraft around. So the crew chief, I'm flying gunner this day. For what reason, I don't know. But anyway, the crew chief says, "Well, all right, we're clear to turn here." And I'm looking out the back and along the fuselage. I said, "It's dark, you know." I go, "Oh my God!" I go, "Wait a minute! Don't move! This is a tree here. The fuselage is touching a tree." So he goes, "Well, come on, boys, you know, give me, you know, tell me something to do, you know," and he's holding the aircraft perfectly steady there. So we figured out, you know, what are we going to do now? I mean, mind you, you know, all this is going on around us. And so I said, "All right, well, we got to pick her up, you know." So we guided him up. We got around that thing. We lowered the aircraft down around it, turned, got facing the right way, dropped the ropes. Those guys, you know, got on. We tugged them up till we got them up, you know, off the ground. And in the meantime, they're in the middle of a firefight, those guys. Right. I mean, you know, they're gutsy. We get them out. We pull them up out of the jungle. We get to the hole. We get out of there. We get out. We're flying. Now, you know, they're dangling there.
Right.
And we're trying to find an opening where we can set them down. And he goes, "Hey, you guys, you did a great job back there." And I was speechless, you know, because he's thanking us. You know, I mean, it was amazing, amazing. Yeah. And I'll tell you the truth, we were right on top of that whole firefight.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, and this will show you what the jungle is.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe that the VC even knew we were there.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
That's how we were able to yank them out of there.
Right.
There were two of those guys who were wounded.
Uh-huh.
But they're special forces. They're a little wacky.
Yeah.
But, and this happened every time that we pulled the alert patrol out. Every time.
Yeah.
They would say, "Let's go get a deer. We want to get a deer." So we'd go brush a deer out, and we'd pop them, and we'd bring the deer back to their base camp.
And we'd
cook the deer up, but it'd be a couple of days later because we had to clean the deer.
Wow.
But they always wanted to get a deer or a pig, you know, anything that they could get. You know, they wanted to go hunting. But even with wounded, they still want to go get a deer. You know, amazing. So anyway, that was the caliber of pilot that we dealt with, and they were terrific. I just mentioned that to him on the internet the other night, and because he had said something, he couldn't remember who the guys in back were on some mission, he said, and I wrote, you know, it doesn't matter what the mission was, Mr. Long, anybody would have flown with you.
Yeah. You know?
And I reminded him of that particular thing, and he didn't even answer me back because I could tell that, you know, I took him by surprise by saying that, you know. But he was a terrific guy. Unbelievable.
Sounds like it. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
Okay, well, in that case, thank you for sharing your story, and we are ending the interview.